We're going to do People's Law Talk with Attorney Kevin King and discuss labor struggles and more in the legal world. And that comes down in 3, 2, 1. Time for our Labor Day weekend special of People's Law Talk with Attorney Kevin King of Klein King & King. And how appropriate today, Kevin, to discuss labor and the law, right?
John, I'll tell you what. Here we are, Labor Day once again.
Yep.
And today's show is going to be about the ebb and flow of labor struggles that have shaped our legal system and our daily lives. So we're going to go historically. As we say, John, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
One thing I always remember about John is Mansfield, Ohio, and the Labor Day celebrations he's always spoke about, which are pretty significant.
Yep.
In terms of there was all sorts of labor parades in that city because it was a good labor town.
Big labor town, yes, sir.
So where are we going to begin the journey? We're going to begin the journey historically about labor in the United States and how it's shaped basically our daily lives in many regards. The Knights of Labor, 1869, I love their motto, always have. The perfect government is one in which an injury to one is a concern of us all. And their platform in 1869 was an 8-hour workday, end of child labor, equal pay, and believe it or not, a graduated income tax. And I'm sure that was probably considered probably a real different idea in 1869. So our next stop along the way is 1886. Labor was having more of an input in the shape of society. There were 1,600 strikes. Most notably in 1886 was the Haymarket Square in Chicago, which occurred between May 1 and May 4, and that was to observance, May Day observance internationally for workers, and that will be an important point when we come back around to that.
Okay.
10,000 marched down Michigan Avenue demanding 8-hour work days and pay increases, and on the evening of May 4th, 2,000 workers gathered, and police and private strike breakers were brought in to break the strike, and broke the strike they did, plus they killed several workers. The Chicago Times referred to the striking workers as, quote, immigrant radicals, stating, quote, whip these Slavic wolves back to the European dens from which they came.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So it goes back certainly to the struggles of labor. Now, in Indiana, John, you and I have talked about this, 1905, Eugene Debs. Mm-hmm. Eugene Debs from Terre Haute, Indiana, was quite an organizer. He was part of the Industrial Workers of the World, also known as the Wobblies. John, do you remember the Wobblies? Maybe by history
class?
Yeah,
there's a little light deep in the recesses flashing there.
Well, yes. We're going to go back into history. So the Wobblies shop, if you worked in a Wobblies shop back in the 1900s, the workers elected their managers. So it was quite an organization wherein the managers and the workers had a close working relationship. Now, as we all know, that Eugene Debs was born in 1855 and raised in Terre Haute, Indiana. In 1893, he organized the first industrial union referred to as the American Railway Union. 1900 through 1908, 1912, and 1920, he ran as a candidate on the Socialist Party for President of the United States. He was quite an organizer. In 1916, he ran for Congress from the state of Indiana. I don't know if a lot of folks know that Indiana had quite a labor background early on. But in 1918, things kind of slowed down for Eugene Debs. He gave a anti-war / labor speech in Canton, Ohio, and which would be a good labor area.
Yes.
He was later arrested and tried in federal court for allegedly violating the Sedition Act of 1918, which was a crime to willfully utter or write any disloyal, profound, or abusive language about any form of government of the United States, including the Constitution. Now, this is what he got nicked on. So listen to this one, folks. It is the working class that fight all the battles, the working class who make the supreme sacrifices, the working class who freely shed their blood and furnish their corpse and have never had a voice in declaring war or declaring peace. It is the ruling class that invariably does both. They alone declare war, and they alone declare peace. That's what sent him to federal prison for
right?
10 years.
My goodness.
Pretty amazing, isn't it?
There it is.
So 1918 in Canton, Ohio, he was sentenced in a federal court. But this is interesting. In 1920, when he was in federal prison in West Virginia, he ran for president and received 1 million votes.
Son of a gun.
Yeah. So 1 month after World War One, Congress repealed the Sedition Act, and President Harding commuted Eugene Debs' sentence in 1921. So Indiana, folks, has quite a foundation in terms of organized labor. Let's go to 1900 then, step a few years back. 1.75 children between the ages of 10 and 15 labored in America. Now, we all know that child labor is, you know, today, just unspeakably, you know, it's just not, you know, it's illegal. We all know that. But sure. 1916, Congress passed what they call the Keating-Owens Child Labor Act, banning the sale of any product that was produced by child labor, and there was no employment of kids under 14 and an 8-hour day work day for kids between 14 and 16. Believe it or not, this passes Congress, but it was challenged by the Southern cotton manufacturers.
Okay.
And their argument in front of the Supreme Court was the interstate commerce deals with transportation, not the manufacture of goods, because the manufacture of goods was a state rights issue. Mm-hmm. And they argued that interstate commerce was intended to stop prostitution, kidnapping, and bootlegging. Believe it or not, the United States Supreme Court overruled the Keating-Owens Child Labor Act, ruled as unconstitutional.
Amazing.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it took another 22 years through the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 to provide permanent protection for kids in the workplace. Another example of the ebb and flow of the struggle of labor mm-hmm. in the United States. Our next step along the way would be 1935, the National Labor Relations Act, and that would have been obviously, under the Roosevelt administration. It was referred to as the Wagner Act, who was a senator from New York. And this was the right for organizations and unions to collective bargain, and it created the National Labor Relations Board. Now, Senator Wagner, introducing this bill, said the following: democracy cannot work unless it is honored in the factory as well as the polling booth. Workers cannot truly be free in body and spirit unless their freedom extends into places where they can earn their daily bread. Pretty good statement, I think.
It is.
So, now, John, back in Mansfield, Ohio, if we take a bit of a break from history, can you tell us some of your experiences about your Labor Day parades?
Oh, they were huge. And at the time, when I would have been working in radio back in those days, which would have been the mid-70s, the unions were still pretty strong and active in that community. But growing up as a kid, Labor Day parades were amazing. United Rubber Workers, Steel Workers were big and had tons of floats and trucks and made a lot of noise, and everybody went.
And everybody was out there.
Everybody was out there. If they weren't marching, they were on the side of the street.
Yep. And if you weren't there, your name was taken down, and someone asked you why the next
why
you didn't show up
in
the shop, right?
Yeah.
So, well, the reason why I asked John about that, because we switched historically into 1947. That was the Taft-Hartley Act. Taft was from Ohio, and Hartley was from New Jersey. Both of them were Republicans. This was during the Harry Truman administration, who was Democratic. And so the Republican Congress decided to provide government the ability to investigate labor disputes and order injunctions against strikes that endangered the health and safety of America, and allowed the president to request the U.S. Attorney General to seek a court order to prevent or block any strike from taking place or continuing. Now, probably, I don't know how that went over at Mansfield, Ohio, probably not very well.
Probably not.
So President Truman described the legislation as, quote, a slave labor bill, end of quote, and vetoed the legislation. Congress overrode his veto, and actually his veto helped his reelection in 1948 mm-hmm. because Harry Truman believed strongly in unions and strong labor. Historically, in 1950, this is one that was pretty interesting. One-third of women over 16 were in the labor force. If we compare that to 2000, it was 60%. So we know that there has been incredible struggles for women in terms of labor. The Equal Pay Act was promoted as early as 1898, but was not codified until 1963. Again, a significant struggle in our country's history. So where does it take us into the 60s? John and I will probably be able to relate to some of these a little bit more closely. 1964 Civil Rights Act. It was unlawful practice as an employer to fail or refuse to hire or otherwise discriminate against an individual because of race. All right, that's 1964, John. You and I can remember that pretty well. or at least I can remember it, and I'm sure you do as well. But it took all the way until then, 1964, to be able to actually have a federal right to say that it's unlawful practice to discriminate based upon someone's race. John, now, where were you in August 1981, and precisely August 3rd, 1981?
Oh, my goodness. I don't
you were
remember
somewhere
where. I was 81, would have been in Ohio, okay. working at the radio station in my hometown.
Well, then I'll tell you what. You got it hot off the news when dealing with the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association strike.
Yes.
You remember this?
Yes,
here we
I
go.
Do
See, John
that.
Now remembers it because he was doing radio.
Yes.
You probably did the announcement when when the air traffic controllers, or 11,000 of them, decided to strike because they were concerned about unfair wages and long hours.
Yep.
Right? So, and what happened after that, Reagan fired every one of the 11,000 air traffic controllers, which dealt a serious blow to the labor movement. Now, I was in law school during the 80s, and yes, I could see a shift in the whole idea of labor relations relative to legal matters. And during the 80s, business schools and even some law schools were providing information, manuals to business leaders to learn from Reagan's actions to break strikes.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a significant shift legally in the 1980s of how the law and businesses were dealing with labor unions. And a lot of people say that since 1981, that dealt a significant blow to labor. John, do you know why Labor Day is in September and not May?
No.
Okay, well, historically, 1894, Grover Cleveland authorized federal troops to break the Pullman strike in Chicago,
okay.
which was led by Eugene Debs. The Pullman strike lasted from May 11th to July 20th, 1894. It began with Pullman wanting to cut wages by 25%. Cleveland recognized the Pullman strike breaking was very detrimental and ugly to labor disturbance. So he authorized federal troops to go in and break it. There were scores of labor folks that were killed. So because of his actions, he thought that a Labor Day Act of 1894 would be appropriate. He was signed into law in an attempt to help his reelection status within the Democratic Party in 1896. But the Democrats were very displeased with him, and so Cleveland lost the nomination to William Jennings Bryan, who lost the presidential election to William McKinley, a Republican. Why September and not May? Because May was considered the International Workers' Day, which is considered socialistic.
Gotcha.
And part of the 1894 deal was it has to be in September and not May.
Okay.
And that's kind of a race through history as to the ebb and flow of the labor struggles, and that shaped our lives.
Saw a story here just recently that public opinion of labor unions has gone to where 60% or so of Americans now support them, encourage them. It's kind of an ebb and flow thing over our history,
isn't it? We can see that from where we started 1896 to where we go to the strike breaking to where you just mentioned today. So, it is the ebb and flow of the struggle, always.
So let's talk about, in terms of where we're at, is it a good time for unions or a bad time for unions?
I think it's still a tough time for unions. I still think the strike-breaking tactics by Reagan in the early 80s really dealt, from a legal perspective, it really set the organizing back and also how employers can deal with strikes. It gave the employers leverage, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing that in 1981, and actually in law school, I really enjoyed labor relations, but I could see how it shifted more toward employers in dealing with strikes and not necessarily favorable to unions.
Okay. Attorney Kevin King, People's Law Talk, talking about labor struggles in the law this morning. How appropriate as we head into the Labor Day weekend. Counselor, thanks for your time. Good to see you.
I always enjoy it. Everybody have a good Labor Day weekend, but remember all the folks that allowed you to have an eight-hour work day and fought for all the benefits that they did through the strikes and their efforts.
Back with more in a moment.